Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, we rejoin Hoffman Center nutritionist Layla Mudin for our weekly Q&A with Layla. And that's an opportunity for you to send in your questions if you desire to get your question handled via our podcast. Just email us at radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com, and make your question brief, succinct, and hopefully of general interest to our listening audience. And we reserve the right to be selective about which questions we're going to field. So you got additional questions, right, Layla?
Yes, I do. This actually comes from Dennis. I see the ingredient acetylmyristoliate in a lot of joint formulas and creams. Is it effective in helping with arthritis? And if so, what's the mechanism of action? Now, what I've read about acetylmyristoliate, it's acetylated fatty acid that's been shown in some animal studies to block inflammation and prevent adjuvant-induced arthritis. I'm actually taking this off Wikipedia
Briefly. And you know what some of those adjuvants are? The things that cause arthritis artificially in animals? Sometimes they inject carrageenan.
Wow.
Which is another story entirely. I mean, we're really against carrageenan in our foods and in our supplements, and because that's a pro-inflammatory ingredient. That's just an aside. But okay, so CMO.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what I think
it's been shown. Yeah, it's been shown in some animal studies to block inflammation, but other studies, similar methods, have failed to replicate that outcome. So. A modest anti-inflammatory effect is observed. It probably wouldn't be our first choice in anti-inflammatories. I think curcumin,
squalane,
would definitely be top of the line fish oil, especially for a joint formula or for arthritis.
I got to say, I'm not using it very often, and I'm reading here from WebMD. There's an interest in acetylmyristoliate for osteoarthritis because it's found in certain mice that don't develop arthritis, but that doesn't necessarily mean that giving it to humans will reverse arthritis.
We're not mice after all. We have to be careful how all that is extrapolated,
and correlation is not causation. But they do suggest that it might be helpful for rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritis, ankylosing spondylitis, although I have to say I haven't really used it. They suggest it might be useful in multiple sclerosis, although I haven't used it for that, and my patients seem to do fine. So, I think I'm just looking to see if there's any, briefly, to see if there's any research that's of any great validity.
While you're looking at that, one of the other things to be done for arthritis is, you know, the removal of any foods causing inflammation. Those would be your food allergens, intolerances, sensitivities, but also the nightshades. The nightshade family of vegetables, which are tomatoes, white potatoes, peppers, eggplant, and tobacco. Tobacco is a nightshade. People don't know. So even if you don't smoke, which is wonderful, but if you're around secondhand smoke, you know, you're still ingesting some nightshade.
So here,
hard to do when you live in New York, but...
Here's what I see, you know, when I go to Wikipedia, and excuse me for looking this up, but this is kind of just confirming what I thought, which is that the animal research is promising. It was acetylmyristoliate was first reported to block inflammation and prevent adjuvant-induced arthritis, as you say, at very high doses in rats. Okay, so then maybe a human would have to consume, a pound of it, maybe. But then in follow-up studies in mice, a modest anti-inflammatory effect was observed. But with humans, its possible benefits in the treatment of any medical condition is largely unknown. And the Federal Trade Commission, I'm not necessarily big fans of theirs, they've even taken legal action against supplement manufacturers for exaggerated claims. And there is a little bit of evidence for the benefit of acetylmyristoliate in arthritic patients. One pilot study found that acetylmyristoliate may be beneficial against fibromyalgia, but these are low-quality clinical trials involving only a few individuals. They're not really well-designed, And so these, they say these trials are only of limited scientific evidence in terms of proving efficacy of that. So, you know, I got to say, I think the claims are a little ahead of the science. And when I see, sometimes I see, this has been around for a while. And, you know, I generally feel that if a supplement is worthwhile, that it will stand the test of time. In other words, say, you know, coenzyme Q10 probably got introduced in the, you know, in the 90s. And it wasn't like there was a cessation of studies or interest in it. There were more and more studies, and more, it just built and built and built. And then there was the ubiquinol revolution, and we started seeing studies on ubiquinol. And it wasn't like there was a cessation of research. It was actually, the research has blossomed. And
it's become ubiquitous.
Yes, it is ubiquitous. It's, it is everywhere and pervasive. So, anyway, it, with CMO, that the opposite has happened. Very few studies, mostly done in the 90s and early 2000s, suggested that it could be beneficial, but it hasn't really gone anywhere.
So
that's
why probably not that probably not that effective.
And you know, I remember when it came out, I was interested, and I, you know, I did the research, and I just said, you know, and this happens, you know, I look at stuff and I get excited, and then I say, yeah, but then I wait a little bit sometimes, and then I say, is this going anywhere? And it didn't.
Okay.
Next question.
Okay, next question. Let's see here. This comes from Diane. Diane says, can you talk about Sjogren's syndrome? Also, are there non-drug alternatives to help one stay as healthy as possible with this? Another autoimmune.
Right. Well, Sjogren's syndrome is, it's got a Swedish name, so it's impossible to pronounce. S-J in Swedish is pronounced sh. So it's, if you wanted to read it phonetically from the way it's spelled, it would be Sjogren's syndrome, but it's Sjogren's syndrome. And it's a condition in which you may experience dry eyes, dry mouth. And then you may also have internal organ involvement. And it's a fairly common autoimmune disease, especially among women. It's one of the things that you look for in a patient who complains of dry eyes. And actually, we have a fair number of our patients who have mild to moderate Sjogren syndrome.
Yes.
And so, you know, things that we use, well, why don't you start with suggestions for that?
Well, first of all, we like to remove a gold standard in nutrition for any autoimmune condition. First thing, removal of gluten and dairy. Even if the patient is not sensitive, the removal of gluten and dairy often is efficacious.
Sure.
So that's job number one, at least for me. Secondly, taking things like fish oil to increase
And lots of fish oil. We really lube these patients up.
Fish oil as well.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Fish oil, borage oil, ModuCare, because of the autoimmune component to this.
Right.
Is often very helpful.
And for the dry eyes, we might also use borage oil in this case, because the combo of borage oil and fish oil might be what's required to alleviate the eye dryness. High dose vitamin E. You know, maybe 800 of Maxigamma. And certainly vitamin D. There's lots of evidence that in the rheumatological disorders that vitamin D helps to control the autoimmune response.
Can we talk about where we want optimal vitamin D levels? Would you agree anywhere between 50 and 80?
Yeah, that would be appropriate.
That would be it, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
And especially, you know,
a lot of people are coming in saying, but my doctor said I'm taking too much vitamin D, but my vitamin D is 34.
Right.
Well,
that's
you're deficient.
No, the doctor is deficient.
The doctor is deficient in knowledge of vitamin D.
Yeah, it's woeful. It's woeful, you know. It's like, you know, I have to keep up with all aspects of medicine, you know, the latest antibiotics, the latest, you know, conventional drugs, the latest psychiatric meds. I have to know all this stuff. Why can't doctors keep up on developments in nutrition? It's almost like they've closed their eyes to that whole area.
That's true. You know, speaking of which, you were recently comparing a new blockbuster drug versus vitamin D?
Yes.
For heart failure?
Right.
Yeah.
And actually, I have to owe that to Bill Sardi, who wrote a very interesting analysis. And I'll be talking about this on the weekend edition of Intelligent Medicine. It'll be one of our lead stories. Is they developed this drug, and they said this is the most incredible innovation in heart disease prevention in 20 years. This is like a huge breakthrough. It's a drug that can help congestive heart failure. And then, you know, you look at the statistics, and it reduces death from congestive heart failure by 20%, which is tremendous, because they're literally millions of people at risk of congestive heart failure. And so a drug that could reduce their risk of death by 20% would be great. But what about nutritional therapy, especially vitamin D and, you know, coenzyme Q10 and things like that? And those, he does this very convincing statistical comparison. Merely prescribing patients vitamin D helps the pumping action of the heart, reduces death from congestive heart failure. Mm-hmm. Why isn't that the headline? And, oh, by the way, this drug is going to make billions of dollars. It's like, you know, this is what the pharmaceutical industry has been waiting for. It's like the holy grail to revive this flagging industry, you know, which doesn't have any new successful drugs in the pipeline. And
their patents are due to expire, the ones they currently have anyway.
By the way, you know, I'm not commenting on the merits of the drug. I think it's too early to tell, but unfortunately, with many of these drugs, they're highly touted, and then they crash and burn within a year or two or three.
So this remains to be seen.
Yes, indeed.
Okay.
So that was Sjogren's.
Yeah.
What else we got?
Let's see here. We have another question from Jan. Dr. Hoffman, would you please talk about hypertension? What might be some of the things to do for hypertension?
Wow. That's a very, very amorphous subject.
That should be a clinical focus of yours if you haven't already done it.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, absolutely, and that's something we're going to do maybe sometime soon. But, you know, in short, hypertension is actually an artificial thing, because we just decided that a device that you put around somebody's arm and you pump it up is going to give us a useful measurement that's going to tell us whether a person needs a medication or whether it needs diet and lifestyle or natural therapy. It actually is an artificial construct. And so we have to remember that. It's not like an absolute. So, you know, everybody says, well, my blood pressure needs to be 120 or 80. Well, actually, studies show that it depends. If you have no other risk factors and you're an active senior adult, you don't need your blood pressure controlled as carefully as if you have both diabetes and hypertension. Or if you've had a stroke, you absolutely need to control your blood pressure. Or if you've had a heart attack, or if you have congestive heart failure, that's when blood pressure control becomes more mandatory. So we have to individualize. It's not like one size fits all. Everybody needs blood pressure medication. Secondly, there are multiple causations of high blood pressure. One person's high blood pressure may be alleviated with a completely different set of lifestyle recommendations and medications than another's. I mean, I love it when overweight patients come in with high blood pressure, because we get them to lose a little weight and their blood pressure normalizes. Or if we have a patient who has an abnormal glucose tolerance test, they have metabolic syndrome. So metabolic syndrome, with actually your sugar and your insulin is associated with your blood pressure. So we fix that with diet modification, certain supplements, blood pressure goes down. Other patients that worry me, like a skinny patient who comes in and has got high blood pressure. Well, what's going on there? Is that a super tense person? Are they very hyper tense? And that's why they have hypertension.
Cortisol off the charts.
Or alternatively, do they have like some kind of kidney problem, or is it some genetic predisposition?
Yeah.
Then this whole salt controversy. There's some people who are very salt responsive. They need to curtail their salt consumption. There are others where salt consumption backfires. Their body actually
compensates.
It compensates because you don't have enough blood volume. You know, your sodium actually will cause you to increase your water retention, and when you have less water retention, the body may clamp down the blood vessels. You get an artificially elevated blood pressure. So there's also
another source of, off the top of my head, and I'm thinking about a patient that you and I recently saw.
Yep.
He was having three beers an evening.
Bingo.
And he was told with high blood pressure.
Yep.
He was put on Bisalic.
Yep.
We also found out he had a little bit of metabolic syndrome, which we took care of.
Yes.
But he stopped drinking the beer every evening.
Right.
And he's no longer having to take Bisalic.
That's
now,
good.
That's a happy dance for
yes.
me.
Yes, yes, yes.
Anyone who's able to come off medication.
Sure. It's been estimated that about half of patients with hypertension, if they followed some reasonable lifestyle measures and lost just 5% of their body weight, could come off their medication.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a real thing. I'm not inalterably opposed to medication. Elevated blood pressure that is not properly controlled can damage the brain, can damage the heart, can damage the kidneys, can lead to kidney dialysis. It's a bad thing. So, you know, there's some people who are denialists. They just don't pay attention to their blood pressure. That's a disaster. Things that lower blood pressure, magnesium, garlic will lower blood pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly
olive leaf will lower blood pressure.
Olive leaf,
picanolagenol.
By the way, I picked up a new sponsor that you'll be hearing from. I'm very excited. It's there, and you'll hear more and more about this in the next few weeks. They make a really concentrated beet extract. Now, beet extract is interesting because it generates nitric oxide in the bloodstream. And this can be used by athletes to improve circulation and athletic performance. It's proven. It's actually scientifically proven. Also, for individuals with high blood pressure, if you dilate the blood vessels and expand them, the blood pressure goes down. So some people, you know, it's a lot easier to swallow a pill or take a powder in a liquid, in a glass of water, than to drink a whole, you know, freshly juiced beets, and you can actually get a comparable effect from convenient supplements. So I'm very happy to get this new sponsor. I just talked to the ad agency today, and you know, I just like to take sponsors with products that I think are legit, and I'm anxious to test drive this product for my own athletic performance because it's actually been shown in cyclists to improve their times and their endurance, and you know, that's a big issue because you know, you want to always extend your ability to pump blood to your extremities when you're exercising.
Right. Terrific. Okay.
So that's one thing. I mean, you could actually just drink some beet juice. There's also a type of tea, which is foul tasting. What is that blood pressure tea? I'll look it up. It's not chrysanthemum.
It's on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah, I'll
it's some kind of passion flower or something?
No, not passion flower. It's something like that. Hibiscus.
I knew
it was a flower. Yeah, hibiscus tea has been a traditional remedy for high blood pressure in the Middle East. And also celery. But not forget fish oil. Let's not forget vitamin D. They play important roles. Magnesium,
celery also induces nitric oxide production as well.
Sure.
So,
sure.
Yeah. Yeah. The nitrates. So these are, definitely exercise. Exercise.
Oh,
a little weight loss.
Goes
like
without
you
saying. Yep.
All of these. You can be taken care of quite well, quite easily for most people.
Right.
Okay. Oh, we've got another question here from Nancy.
We have time for one more question. Great.
Great, great. Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I am a 64-year-old woman and my husband is 66. We are both in good health and we lead healthy lifestyles. Lately, it seems that so many of our friends and family in their 60s and 70s are coming down with AFib.
Yes.
Are there any preventive measures that we could do to lessen our chances of developing this? You know, it seems to be pandemic.
Yeah, it is. Well, okay. By the way, I did a whole feature on Pradaxa, a medication used for patients with AFib. It's a blood pressure medication. It's now thought to be potentially dangerous, and it was approved. And the drug manufacturer, Boehringer Ingelheim, withheld data about its potential hazards. And that's actually, in this week's newsletter, that's going to be my lead story. So check it out. So it doesn't fix the AFib, but it's designed to thin the blood. It's considered a replacement for Coumadin, and was said to be an improvement, but now there are a lot of concerns about it. So anyway, so what do you do to prevent AFib? Well, okay, you obviously protect your heart. And so what can you do to protect your heart? Well, make sure your blood pressure is optimal, because actually AFib sometimes results from chronic damage to the heart that occurs with hypertension. So that's one reason that it occurs. I believe that you can possibly prevent it with adequate magnesium, with coenzyme Q10 or ubiquinol, with fish oil. These are some of the things that could be beneficial. Taurine may be helpful also for the electrical conduction in the heart. And, you know, exercise, but exercise in moderation.
Yeah, would there be any other cause of AFib besides blood pressure?
I just think it's worn out hearts, and
gotcha.
You know,
okay.
People live longer than they originally intended, and so this is becoming more common. Mm. But it, you know, it also may be the result of stress and tension. It may be the result of hypoglycemia, because ups and downs of blood sugar can trigger arrhythmias. It may be also the result of chemical exposure and toxicity, because the toxicity may damage the nerves. And we don't precisely know why it occurs. So,
and what do you think about people being given Coumadin or any other?
You have to. I mean, this is one fundamental way in which I disagreed with the late, great Dr. Atkins, because I would hear him on his radio show say, oh, you don't need to take Coumadin. You can just take these blood-thinning things. Take garlic and fish oil and vitamin E and, you know, and I thought that may not be reliable enough, because those things can thin the blood, but not to the point where Coumadin does. It's not as controllable. Coumadin is a terrible drug, but at least it thins the blood.
It's rat poison, unfortunately.
It is rat poison, and it's, you know, controlled doses, it will thin the blood. And it's hard to use, potentially dangerous, but, you know, there's nothing worse than a stroke that could be prevented.
Absolutely.
And people who are walking around with atrial fibrillation, they can walk around for years with it and not get a stroke, but at any given moment, they might get one. So you need to thin the blood. So another thing, a point I'll make about exercise, is that too much exercise actually increases your risk for atrial fibrillation. And that's one of the reasons why I do a lot of exercise, but I am not going to be one of those who wants to. You know, I just heard about a 65-year-old is doing the Ironman triathlon. Is that good? Hey, more power to him or her. But is that going to be good long-term? The heart can sometimes enlarge with really heavy-duty endurance athletes who are obsessed with exercise. I mean, that's another thing. What's that doing? You have to spend, like, you know, 3-4 hours a day exercising. Is that a good headspace for you to be in? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. The heart can enlarge, and you can damage the conduction system in your heart. And there is a higher incidence of arrhythmias in people who are very heavy exercisers. This is not applicable to the vast majority of our audience, because the vast majority of our audience, their eyes are exercising moderately or not enough. So, but at extremes, you know, too little exercise, not good. Too much can cause this type of problem to arise. Not uncommon in really big time marathoners and ultra endurance athletes.
Yeah. All right.
So, yeah, those are some of the alcohol. Absolutely.
Alcohol can cause AFib.
Big time, big time.
Sure.
You know, we had this. I used to work at the VA hospital here in Manhattan, and one of the things about the vets is that many of them were Korean War and Vietnam and even World War II era vets. And one thing, apparently, that you learn to do in the Army is drink a lot, and the Navy. And so we get these vets, and they were, you know, they were drinkers. And we would dread being on call during the 4th of July or Labor Day or Memorial Day. We would call the patients who were admitted those days as suffering from holiday heart. Very often, they'd be admitted in atrial fibrillation. They were fine until they started to throw back six-packs or, you know, drink, you know, lots and lots of whiskey, vodka, gin, their preferred rot gut, cold 45, because it actually is toxic to the heart. It damages the heart at those high levels. I mean, alcohol in moderation may be somewhat protective to the heart, but in high amounts, it is absolutely damaging to the tissue, to the muscles of the heart, and to the nerves.
Yeah. So, Nancy, there you go. That's our advice.
Doesn't sound like Nancy's going to be in danger of.
Hitting
the bottle. Doesn't sound like she's like a. Sounds like a sober, responsible individual.
Yep.
And that's what our listeners are here on Intelligent Medicine. They're sober, responsible individuals. They take charge of their own health, and they're part of a grassroots movement to take back America's health and well-being, and we appreciate
that. Feel empowered, yes.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And it's great working with you all. It's great working with you one-on-one at the Hoffman Center. Layla and I thank you. And that's it for today's edition of Q&A with Layla. Thanks for joining us, Layla.
Thanks, Dr. Hoffman.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.